Good afternoon. I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Thursday, October 29th, 2015. We're meeting here in Juneau. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:02 p.m. Committee members present: Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Coghill, Senator Stedman, Senator Stoltz, Senator Wielichowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. I believe that Senator Machiki will be along shortly. Thank you, Ann Kreckelberg, for being here today recording our minutes, and Betsy Dorn is handling our audio today. So today we're going to hear from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And, you know, just for fun, this summer, my youngest sister and I happened to be working on my mother's house. She's moved to a Pioneer home, and she saved newspapers. And so I got to find these wonderful old newspapers. So here's one from June 20th, 1977. Oil flows finally. This was the first day of flow through the pipeline. So again, that was June. So here's, this is the Fairbanks Newsman, by the way. Check out the size of this paper. Then you open it up, you know. And I mean, these were monster papers. So then we have Thursday, September 8th. 1977. It's Alcan all the way. This refers to a gas pipeline that was being proposed, right? And it says here the Alcan project proposes construction of a 48-inch pipeline, roughly parallel to the Alaska Highway through the Yukon Territory. And there's the map. So the next year, in March, comes out a petrochemical information or petrochemical study for Fairbanks, what it would mean for manufacturing using this natural gas. So it was, these were wonderful archaeologic discoveries in my mother's house. I will tell you, it was full of stuff. But those were kind of fun. I thought I'd bring them today just for fun. And I know many folks on AGDC were actually here when first oil flowed through taps. So now here we are with another pipeline. Senator Stedman.
Madam Chairman, just for a audience at home, because back when I got out of high school, all the stuff was going on, they were talking about those very things. But reflecting back on our last presentation, they couldn't have even got a permit to offtake the gas because they would have left billions of dollars of wealth in our oil fields. And I think the industry gets a bad rap for not building a pipeline 10, 20, 30 years ago. But it was in our, the people of the state of Alaska's best interest along with theirs, not to, to wait till this moment in time. And I think that's one of the information pieces that we should be getting out there to alleviate a lot of the misinformation in waiting for this gas line.
Very good, Senator Stedman. Well said. So yesterday, there was a rollout by the Attorney General. It was centered around the plan for Alaska to operate more of a conventional wealth type fund. Today's presentation is an extension of how we might do that, how we might grow the pie with our of our fossil fuel economy in a commercially viable way. So today we're going to try to answer some of the questions about how we, as a state, step into the role of TransCanada from a practical, mechanical perspective. And I'm thrilled because we have at least one engineer for sure at the table. I love engineers because they get right to the point. So I welcome Mr. Joe Dubler and Mr. Frank Richards, who are here in Juneau. And on the line, we have Mr. Dan Felsky. We can talk about roles when they introduce themselves. Miles Baker, Bruce Tangeman, Fritz Krusen, and Ken Vassar. So welcome to Mr. Dubler and Mr. Richards, if you'd put yourself on the record, and you've given us a PowerPoint today.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Frank Richards, Vice President of Engineering and Program Development for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
And Madam Chair, Joe Dubler, Vice President of Commercial Operations for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, I'll let you proceed. I will encourage committee members to ask questions as we go. That way we can address issues as they come up in your mind, rather than wait till the end. So go ahead.
Madam Chairman, again, just to start the conversation, we really wanted to identify what our the state's objectives were in the creation of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And that was to provide for a stable long-term supply of energy for Alaskans, utilizing the great natural resources that we have available, proven resources on the North Slope of Alaska. And with that, then, it would maximize the value of those resources that would then help generate income for the state of Alaska. Ultimately, creating that revenue, but also jobs and economic development growth for the state, including enhanced oil and gas development. So those are the parameters.
Great. I also want to welcome Senator Michiki, who just joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So AGDC, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, is actually the creation of the legislature. Originally under House Bill 4, we were created as a response to concerns over declining Cook Inlet natural gas supplies and the potential loss of those supplies to South Central Alaska, and then looking out towards Fairbanks with the high energy costs in interior Alaska, providing an access to those natural gas resources from the North Slope, but also in taking into account the health impacts with the particulate matter, especially during the winter in Fairbanks, and its impacts on the health of the citizens up there by supplying clean natural gas, then that would reduce a lot of that particulate matter. And that was the sense of urgency that created AGDC to be able to move forward with an in-state natural gas pipeline to be able to access almost 33 trillion cubic feet of natural gas of proven reserves on the North Slope. So in 2011, the governor at the time, Sean Parnell, called for a joint effort by the producers along with the state to look at an LNG export facility, because at the time we were looking at an overland route through to Canada, but we looked then, based on the commercialization and the impact and the explosion of shale, what it would mean to that project, and then ultimately that an LNG project may be the best way to go forward for the state. And so concept selection work was done and concluded that a Nikiski site was the lead site for the liquefaction plant for an Alaska project, and heads of agreement were negotiated between the owner, the producers, and the state of Alaska. And then that culminated then in 2014 with the passage of Senate Bill 138, providing for state participation in the Alaska LNG project and a joint venture agreement that initiated the front-end engineering and design, or pre-FEED. Next, please. So if I may, we wanted to at least give some of the authorities granted under Senate Bill 138, and that was giving AGDC that primary responsibility for developing an LNG project on the state's behalf. And that allowed us to then have the direct ownership interest in any component of an LNG, Alaska LNG project. And we're also allowed to enter into then the contracts relating to the treatment, transporting, liquefying, and marketing that gas, in this case in consultation with the agencies of DNR and DOR, Department of Natural Resources and Department of Revenue. But also it was clearly provided that AGDC shall assist those agencies to maximize the value of the gas resources and provide for the economic benefits of the state and revenues to the state.
So this brings to mind expansion. Does AGDC have part of its mandate to look at expansion? That is bringing in, you know, how expansion would be executed?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that's explicit in the statutes that we look at expansion. The project itself, we are developing expansion principles for the project with the co-venturers.
Joe Dubler.
Pardon me, Madam, for the record, Joe Dubler.
Thank you. Senator Kogia.
And maybe this will be helpful. AGDC was at first put together to get gas to Alaskans. That was its primary reason for existence. And then the AKLNG project came along, and it looks like at this point you're from Senate Bill 138 and beyond to work with this bigger project or different project, AKLNG. And it sounds to me like, and I've actually had some confusion on those different authorities, because one has a different set of authorities than the other. Can you help maybe the general public and me understand how you parse those out?
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Coghill. Like you stated, AGDC was originally created in 2011, I believe, as a result of a study done by a group put together by the legislature in Senate Bill House Bill 369. That directed us to prepare a report on the feasibility of a bullet line, you know, the so-called bullet line, or ASAP was the acronym that we used, the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. And in the impetus for that was the shortfall of natural gas in Cook Inlet, or the projected shortfalls of natural gas in Cook Inlet. The large fields that had been discovered in the 60s were dwindling, were getting down. There were times where the governor or the mayor of Anchorage had brownout practices and everybody got excited. And so they looked at, well, where else can we get gas to supply South Central Anchorage and the Mat Valley and the Kenai Peninsula? And the North Slope is a logical place. That's where most of the gas in the state is. So we did the study on the ASAP project for a 737-mile, 24-inch pipeline in the initial stage to deliver gas to Alaskans. The deliver gas to Alaskans part of our mission won't change regardless of which project we're in. We will still be developing offtakes, and we've got some slides in this pack about the stuff we've done for the in-state work. We've done a lot of analysis on the demand, the supply that's in Cook Inlet, because there's a window where the Cook Inlet will still be declining, but it tails off. It doesn't just drop. So there'll be a shortfall in future years between the amount that's available from Cook Inlet and what we're projecting as usage from those fields. So what we're going to do with the Alaska LNG project is make up those differences, as well as Frank stated, provide natural gas at least to Fairbanks and other communities along the route to the extent we can get appropriations to get gas to them. I mean, it's going to be expensive, and we've got those numbers in here as well. There's a lot of offtake kit that's required that's going to be fairly expensive given the number of people in the communities.
Yeah, and Madam Chair,
yes.
I just needed to hear it said out loud again, because every once in a while on authority issues we get bumped up against what your original authority was and then what the additional authority was. And one was directly in-state, one was attaching yourself to an LNG project. And when it came to authority, got tangled up reading through the statutes trying to figure out, did you really have the authority? Because it looks like the original operative language in the 138 in the statute was for in-state primarily, and that it didn't really get trumped by 138 until I had read it carefully. So you're actually asked to do a couple of different things, and I just wanted to make sure that people heard that out loud, because I struggled with it just reading through the statutes.
Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question to you has to do with the new direction of the board, and I was looking through your transcription of your September 23rd meeting this year, and it sounds like there was a subcommittee that made a presentation to the full board in which you are presented with $10 million to study a 48-inch pipe. And then there's a discussion that follows that in which one of the members of the board is questioning where that authority came from to authorize the $10 million. And then there's a further discussion where Mr. Fowsky says, we didn't have a vote on it, but we supported the concept. And then those members, because TransCanada represents the state's portion of the midstream, which is pipe, and you go on to say that TransCanada had a vote on spending $40 million, and then the state's portion of that is $10 million for AGDC to study a pipe that's 40 inches. And so it sounds to me that the decision-making process on the board of AGDC is a little confusing. And one of the members actually says, and I just want to understand one thing, so the decision to evaluate a 48-inch had nothing to do with AGDC. I mean, that decision was made because I never saw it come before this board. So could you talk about just two things? You know, is there a change of direction, and how can the public and the legislature have confidence that decisions made by AGDC are made by the board and not filter through from a committee that then board members are surprised that there's a commitment made?
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Costello, the first thing I'd just like to make one minor correction. The work was not done by AGDC for the 48-inch study. The work was to be done by the project management team of the Alaska LNG project. And that project management team was the midstream project portion of the project management team, over which AGDC has no oversight. We are in the liquefaction portion of the project only. The midstream portion, which is the pipeline portion, is represented, the state's interest is represented by TransCanada. So when I talked about a vote to approve those expenditures, we didn't go to our board and ask them about it because we're not involved in that segment of the project. TransCanada is, and TransCanada voted in the affirmative.
Follow up,
please, Senator Costello. So
then if the legislature votes as the governor is recommending we do to go our separate ways with TransCanada, does the state then take up the portion that decision resulted in, which is $40 million then to study a 48-inch pipe?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, again, Joe Dubler from AGDC. Yes, they would, and when we get back to our appropriation numbers, you'll see one of the changes in scope that's identified as a differential in the work program and budget for the calendar year 2016 is that $40 million.
Thank you.
Also wanted to greet Senator Dunleavy, who's joined us. Thank you. Senator Coghill.
Just on the 48-inch line, and I understand that it's a question that was brought before the AKLNG project management team. But I also remember that it was the governor that had written a five-point letter, if I remember correctly, and one of the last points was that he was pushing the project team to incorporate the 48. So I don't know that it was TransCanada that, I mean, they had the vote, but I think the push came from the governor because I think it was initiated from that letter.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I believe you are correct.
I wanted to make that clear.
Very good. So as long as we're talking about the 48-inch line, I mean, that we're talking about expansion, we're talking about your three bullet points, maximum value for the state's gas resources, economic benefits, revenue to the state. So 48-inch line would accommodate more gas. Are there things that you, when you take over for AGD, for TransCanada, need to be doing? Well, actually, no, yes, take over for TransCanada because they've got the gas treatment plant. What kinds of things will you have to be doing to prepare for other gas, for expansion of the amount of gas in the pipeline? Will there be engineering things you have to do now? That gas treatment plant, how does it get expanded? What is your knowledge about those kinds of things?
Certainly, Madam Chair, an expansion to a project like this, it's an integrated LNG project. Mm-hmm. An expansion won't occur until first gas and probably well after first gas until you've established what the true throughput of the project is, because it may end up, if you've just got a small amount of gas, you may not need to expand. You may do what they call debottlenecking, and that's where you make minor improvements, minor changes to the kit that you've got in place without adding additional trains. You can increase the throughput of a project. So you may be able to accommodate small amounts of gas through debottlenecking. To the extent you cannot, and there is an expansion from a third party or from one of the producers or the state, which the four parties involved would have to initiate the expansion, and it would be from the company that is running the project. There will be a company set up to manage the Alaska LNG project, similar to Alyeska Pipeline that runs TAPS, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. There will be a management company that operates the asset on behalf of the owners. So that would be the company that would be approached by one of the participants that wish to make an expansion on behalf of either themselves or a third party. That company would then undertake to do a study and see what was required to expand for the amount of gas that they need, that they would like to put into the project, and then they'd come back and say, okay, this is what it's going to cost for the third party to expand the project, and then they would make a decision at that point whether to proceed with the expansion or not.
When you describe something like Alyeska Pipeline, so my understanding is that the producer companies actually have formed that consortium, and they control that pipeline. But I've also heard AGDC talk about owner-builder-operator, and I believe you're speaking now about an operator. True. So are you envisioning the three companies in the state of Alaska forming a consortium like Alyeska Pipeline is, the management of Alaska Pipeline to operate the pipeline, what kind of thing is being envisioned there for operator?
Madam Chair, it would be the three producer parties in AGDC, not the state of Alaska. AGDC right. will be the ownership in the project, but yes, it would be an operating company that is created and with ownership identical to the parties participating interest in the project. So the state would, if it elects to take royalty in kind and the producers elect to pay their taxes gas, it would be approximately 25% state ownership of that company and the related assets.
So when it comes down to a vote to expand, this you, representing the state of Alaska, vote yes, we would like to expand to allow company X to bring gas from the foothills. What if the three producers who have three other votes vote no? How does that happen? How would we expand?
Madam Chair, we're currently negotiating those agreements, and the position that the state has taken and AGGC is taking is that no party can block an expansion, and we're trying to prevent that very case from happening. So that if someone has a proven amount of gas, they've got gas available, and they've got the money, they've got the capital to be able to expand the project, they would be able to do so. That's our position currently. Like I said, we're still negotiating those documents.
Okay, all right. I think I recall in one of our AKLNG updates that the person who wants to make the expansion actually pays for the cost of that. Is that true, or is it parsed out among AGDC and the three companies, our three partners already?
Madam Chair, that hasn't been decided either. We're still negotiating. That's one of the negotiating points.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any further questions on this slide? Senator Stedman.
Just a quick comment, I think, on that point on expansion. That point's been argued all along the proposed transcontinental line and now through the LNG project. I mean, that's been a big issue. It's never been resolved, and at some point it would be nice to go into the details of that to bring up to speed some of our new members and some of our people at home that aren't that familiar with it, because it's a huge issue. And it was one of the big bottlenecks that we had for quite some time in this building a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions on this page? All right.
Slide 6, Madam Chair, at a very high level, shows the AGDC's role in the Alaska LNG project currently. We did sign the joint venture agreement, which puts us into the partnership with the three producers in TransCanada. We do hold the state's 25% equity in the LNG project, or in the LNG terminal and marine. We've got members on the sponsor group, a member, Dan Fowski, the management committee, myself, and the project steering committee, which is Fritz Krusen, and we'll go through those committees on the next slide in more detail. We participate in integrated project decisions, commercial negotiations, and we're planning and developing offtakes for in-state gas deliveries, and those are, we've got more slides on those later on as well.
Senator Carshaw.
So probably the detail in the later slides, the questions that many of us are asking is, Once it looks like TransCanada will go ahead and exit, and you will become the operator, the negotiator for the midstream as well as for the liquefaction and the conditioning plant, holding at that point all of the state's interests, you'll be involved in governance, you'll be involved in commercial issues. And so the question has come up on the board being the decider for Alaska. And so many of us are wondering about that structure, about because it looks to us like, okay, if TransCanada goes and you step up, then you're going to be representing the state's interests in a pretty large project. So for that, we're grateful. We're grateful that the AGDC team seems to be ramped up to that. But the appointment then to the AGDC board becomes a bigger deal for state's interest and your legal counsel and how you negotiate for commercial agreements, right? We'll probably talk to the Attorney General again about counsel and things like that. But at this point, you are going to step into a place where you're going to be negotiating things that are deep industry concerns, and so confidentiality becomes the, kind of the next big question is, how do you do that? So it's my understanding that confidentiality agreements have been signed by some of the AGDC members. Can you tell me who and how many and how you're going to deal with that? Because going forward, it might be different than the way you've been doing it. So kind of give us an idea of how you think you'll move forward.
Certainly, through the Chair, Senator Coghill, to my knowledge, two of our board members have signed confidentiality agreements, the board chair and the vice chair, John Burns, and Dave Cruz. I both signed the agreements.
And, just name the rest of the members so that people can hear the names of the people on that board.
Sure. There's Hugh Short is another one, Commissioners of Commerce and Labor.
Commissioner Heidi Drygrass, Commissioner Chris Sladek, former Senate President Rick Halford, and Joe Merrick.
And the newer members probably at this point have not signed the confidentiality agreement. That seems to be a little bit of a lightning rod. But if you're going to be going into commercial agreements, is it anticipated that you will enter into those negotiations with that kind of tool at hand or not?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, the current thought on the confidentiality agreements, we put out for public comment some regulations that we're closing up the public comment period, I believe, this week, and those would more clearly define how we would handle confidential information. The public comments we have received quite a few public comments to date, and we will be addressing those with the board at the next meeting.
So since I haven't read those yet, and I certainly haven't read the comments, did the other members of the AKLNG team comment on that?
I believe we did receive comments from...
We did.
I don't know if it was all of them, but I know at least two of them planned on submitting comments.
That's a matter of public record.
Yes.
So we could find that out. So we should be able to dig into that.
Yes.
I think that's something that we should know. So thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Good. Any other questions at this point? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you. From the discussions we've had with a variety of folks who've come before either Senate Finance or this committee, it's obvious that the move to buy out TransCanada has been thought about in advance. And obviously one of the things we've learned is that having a larger voice that's commensurate with our ownership in the gas of 25% is one of the benefits of doing it. So I'm surprised that who your nominee would be to the project management committee hasn't been decided. And it seems to me that that's something that the legislature and the public would want to know what your thoughts are on who that person is. I mean, you've gone and set up two corporations. You're setting the stage or the foundation for this next step, and yet one of the big questions is who will that be, and I'm wondering if it could be a secondee from TransCanada, or if it can't be, or just if you could comment on who that nominee might be.
Through the Chair, Senator Costello, I'm not familiar with the nominee for which committee. I'm sorry.
The project, the group that has the decision-making authority.
The project management team.
Yes.
Okay. Good. The project management team is actually all secondees from all the co-venturers, and the way that process works is similar to hiring an employee. The venture comes out if there's a vacancy, and when TransCanada employees leave, there will be vacancies, and they will submit the vacancies to the co-venturers, and everybody that wants to can put in a name for one of the vacant positions. And that's the way positions have been filled to date on the project, and that will continue to be done that way in the future. And as far as what people we've got, I think Frank would probably be a better person to address that question.
Madam Chairman, with your indulgence, we can move forward to that slide that actually identifies the project management team structure.
Actually, before we do that, I wanted to tag on to some of the questions that Senator Coghill had about the confidentiality agreements. So you put out some regulations, and they're either close to public comment or they're going to be soon. So who drafted those regulations?
Madam Chairman, we have our General Counsel, Ken Basser, online, and I think it would be he'd be the best person to address that.
Okay, sounds good. Mr. Basser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Ken Basser, General Counsel to AGDC.
Welcome.
Thank you. The evolution of confidentiality with AGDC began with what I think is closer to the private industry model of confidentiality, which is to say that everything is confidential, including the menu from which lunch was selected. With AKLNG, we signed several confidentiality agreements that followed that model. I think, as you know, with the election, Governor Walker's administration has a strong view that public business should be more open and transparent than that. And so the position that the administration takes is that only those things that need to be kept confidential should be the subject of confidentiality agreements. And so the regulations that we drafted in close discussion and cooperation with the Attorney General and in particular Jerry Judé, one of the senior assistant attorney generals. He was the assistant attorney general that was assigned by the attorney general to represent us. SB 138 altered AGDC's laws, AS 3125, to put the attorney general in as our counsel for negotiating and drafting documents related to AKLNG. And so that's where that's where the confidentiality issue was met, if you will, was particularly with respect to AKLNG. But more generally, as a general principle of what are the things that AGDC should treat as confidential. We work closely with the Department of Law, with Jerry Judé in particular, and with Craig Richards, the Attorney General, and drafted regulations. Those regulations, as has been said before, those regulations are still in draft form. They've been presented to the public and have been the subject of a public hearing. We've received comments from the producers, particularly fairly significant comments. Our plan is to review those comments and formulate our responses to them and take our responses with the comments to the Board of Directors at the next available meeting for their consideration. And then it will be up to the Board of Directors to determine whether they want to adopt the regulations or whether in the form that they're in or whether they want to make changes to them, or for that matter, it would be within their discretion not to adopt regulations at all.
Interesting. So, Mr. Vassar, you presented a contrast. You contrasted what the private sector industry does in terms of their view of confidentiality with an administrative view that, frankly, things should be fairly open. So I haven't read your regulations, but I'm assuming you adopted the more open model. What if the companies, our three producer partners, don't agree with that more open confidentiality regulations that possibly could be adopted? It seems like that could be sort of a difficult position.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ken Vassar again. I think it's safe to say, and I don't think it comes as a surprise to anybody, that as a matter of fact, the producer company don't like the draft that we prepared. And they, as I said, they have submitted comments and questions. It's going to come down to I'm not sure you'd call it a negotiation, but at least one of the companies has indicated that they would find it difficult to work with us under the regulations. If I could go back and just clarify what I called previously the private industry model. This goes back to the original creation of ATDC, which included, as you know, a lot of powers that people noticed were broader than the average powers that were given to other public corporations. And one of those was to enter into confidentiality agreements. And the theory was that in order to be able to make progress on the ASAP project, we were going to need to be able to get information from private industry. And private industry has no obligation to give us their information whatsoever. So we needed that flexibility to be able to embark on putting together the ASAP project. So those confidentiality agreements followed more closely the private industry standard. State government takes, I would say, the exact opposite approach to confidentiality. The Public Records Act, the Open Meetings Act, all of those kinds of things that state government operates under really start with the premise that the public's business, it should be done in the open, and the public should be aware of what we're doing and the kinds of agreements that we enter into. Governor Walker and Attorney General Richards are strong advocates of that position. So we do have a decision point that's coming up as to how we can reach an accord with private industry. The representatives of private industry that we work with who are very used to keeping everything confidential versus working with a state governmental entity, which I think properly should try to keep things as open and available to the public as possible. What we have to do is we have to find some common ground here where we can further the open and transparent policies as far as we can, but also continue to work with the private industry participants. And excuse me, like I said, we do have comments from those private industry participants, and we're going to go through them very carefully, and we will continue to work with the Department of Law, and we will. All I can suggest is that we'll do our best to come up with some common ground where we can try to further both of those interests.
Thank you, Mr. Vassar. As I look at, of course, the statute for AGDC to maximize the value of the state's gas resources, of course, that's why companies keep certain data confidential, because they'll be selling their product to consumers and they don't necessarily want information out in the public. There's also been a lot of talk about the state of Alaska adopting a Norway model where we become a business, and it seems like we're kind of trying to be both, and that may not be compatible, but we'll see how this unfolds. We do have concerns about that. Any other questions at this point? All right. Are we on slide six? No. Are we on slide six?
Seven.
Thank you.
Slide seven is just a picture showing the resource owners and the interest that those owners have in the project, and demonstrating the state's interest is currently split between TransCanada and the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Next. Slide eight, we go into some governance-related issues that have arisen out of the arrangement with TransCanada. And the first one there is an equity alignment. I believe you touched on that earlier, Madam Chair. That's where the state has a 25% ownership of the gas, but they won't actually own 25% of the project that's shipping that gas. It ends up with, if you do the math, about 12.5% of the ownership, and what the state's attempting to do through buying out TransCanada is to levelize that at 25 to represent its entire share of its gas. But voting rights is another issue that, while it hasn't come up yet, there's a potential in the future for it to come up. When there's a segment vote on the project, if it's related to the midstream, it's clear TransCanada gets to vote that vote. If it's related to the downstream, AGDC gets to vote that vote. It's on integrated matters that affect the entire project that could have a problem. If TransCanada wants to vote X and the state or AGDC wants to vote Y, there's an issue that we need to resolve between the two entities. And to date, we haven't been able to come up with a mechanism that works for both entities. And it's because, obviously, the state wants their vote to be the one that counts, and of course, TransCanada wants their vote to be the one that counts, and you both can't have the same thing. So that's where we're at right now. And taking TransCanada's interest back into the state's purview through AGDC would alleviate that voting concern in the future.
So how many times has that conflict occurred where one entity wanted to vote different than the other in our partnership with TransCanada?
Madam Chair, to date it has not happened. And like I said at the outset, it hasn't happened yet, but there is a potential in the future for it to happen. And there's quite a few good examples of how it could. One being for things that are cost-related. TransCanada isn't actually paying the costs of the project, the state is. So they may not be as cost conscious, and this is strictly hypothetical. I have absolutely no reason to believe this, but in theory, TransCanada could be less sensitive to higher costs than the state might be. I don't think that they are. I mean, they're a very conscientious company and a very good company. I've enjoyed working with everybody at their company, very professional. So I don't think that is a concern, but it is a possibility.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Senator Machiki.
Mr. Dubois, I'm just going to give you a chance to sort of clarify that. I think what you perhaps meant to say was that TransCanada's spending might be more directed toward their interests than the state interests, and there are times when those may not be the same priorities in spending. I don't believe that TransCanada would be less cost-conscious. Can you just clarify that so I can understand?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Machiki, that was a much more eloquent description of my intended statement.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Coghill, and then Senator Walikowski.
Real gentleman, to be sure. I think as this thing has become more and more clear to the legislators, the fact that the governor wants to move on without TransCanada, the fact that TransCanada is willing to step aside and say that, you know, our interests aren't lined up anymore, so they're okay with doing this. So then the question comes up onto the vote, and you mentioned one issue, and that is cost alignment with the other AKLNG members. So at this point, the 48-inch would become, once studied, once reviewed, that becomes a vote that you'll deal with, right? Some of the governance issues that you talked about, those are going to be some of the issues that you'd be talking about. What are some of the issues that you anticipate immediate votes on?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, immediate votes, the most pressing is the work program and budget for calendar year 2016. That would be the most pressing vote. After that, there will be all the agreements that we're currently working on. We would have to bring back to our board for approval before we could execute them.
So you can give me a short menu, Madam Chair, of some of the things that are going to be in that work program budget that you see coming your way, because as I understand, that's early December coming up. And the timing of this kind of puts you in the driver's seat to that. It would be interesting for me to know that if you're in the driver's seat, where you're going with it.
Certainly, through the Chair, Senator Coghill, the work program and budget, what it is, it's a detailed line item by line item description of the work that's going to be done in the next calendar year. It has everything, all the engineering, and Frank could probably do a better job. There's a slide later on where we go through some of the changes that we have for the 2016. But it's just the detailed engineering work that's being done, and it shows the scope of the work, and it shows the timing of the work, and it shows the budgeted amount for that work.
So I guess the question is, with all of the regular things that are going to be in there, the scope changes that you have put in this slide deck are going to be some of the things that you will be proposing. Is that the deal?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, those have been proposed by the project management team to the management committee, and Fritz Krusen, who sits on our project steering committee, has briefed me and gone over these issues with me, and he sits with me at the management committee for technical expertise to assist me at the management committee. But it will be voted on early December, and those, I believe there's four items of scope changes that he concurs with all of them.
And then probably one last thing before we get to Senator Wilkowski. My understanding of the voting methodology in the project management team on this is it's either unanimous or no. Unanimous or no-go, is that what I understand correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, for the work program and budget, that does require a unanimous vote of all the parties that are participating in the venture.
So that's one of the reasons why I think guys like me will be asking you more and more, what do you think is going on there? But I'll let other people ask questions. And as we get further into this, I'll probably kind of dig into that a little bit.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Can we talk about additional risks that the state might incur by taking a larger equity stake from TransCanada, for example, abandonment liability with regard to how much we have to pay, the share the state would have to pay for dismantling infrastructure, environmental liabilities, for example, a pipeline rupture, or GTP explosion. Have you analyzed that additional risk to the state and how we would pay for that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the form of the agreement, the precedent agreement that the state has signed with TransCanada, all of the costs are passed through directly to the state. So the state isn't taking on any additional risk by buying out TransCanada. The best description I've heard so far is they've got the same risk, but they're getting twice the reward. In other words, they're not paying TransCanada the return of 7.1% for allowance for funds used during construction, or the equity portion, which ranges from, I believe, 12% to 14% during construction. So those are costs that the state will not be incurring, and there's a cost to the state, obviously, of the equity that the state's going to have to put up because TransCanada's not, but that's an opportunity cost, and I don't believe the state's reinvestment rate is over 7.1% at this point. So,
yes, follow-up, Senator.
So I'm clear. So even though TransCanada would have had an equity share, if there was an explosion of a pipeline, for example, we would have, even after the pipeline's done, flowing gas 20 years down the road, pipeline ruptures, they wouldn't even have to pay for their own equity cost. We would have to pay for their cost at that time. Or abandonment liability when 100 years from now when we're taking this down, hopefully it goes on for longer than that, but we would still be on the hook to pay for their dismantlement costs at that time?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's my understanding, yes.
Can I get legal to weigh in on that and make sure that's the correct interpretation? Because that's a pretty big question.
Yes. We will get you.
Could Mr. Vassar respond to that? You don't believe so? Okay. All right, so you'll have to get back to us, or?
We'll get something to the committee. But Ken Vassar is the AGDC's general counsel, and by statute, he's not our counsel on the Alaska LNG project.
I see.
So he wouldn't be familiar with that agreement.
So if and when TransCanada bows out, what will Mr. Vassar's role be then?
Madam Chair, he would still be the corporation's general counsel. There are other things that the corporation does, the board meetings, things like that. But the work that is drafting agreements and documents is the statutory obligation of the Attorney General's office.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Is this Mr. Fosky?
It is, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Good afternoon to you. I'd like to make a brief, for the record, Dan Fosky, President of AGDC. I was a little troubled by some of the last exchange. We're not signatories to the precedent agreement. And so we will help Senator Wilkowski and we can, but that's under the domain of DNR and the state and the Attorney General's office. We are not a signatory to that agreement.
Thank thank you very much, Mr. Foskey, for clarifying that. We will direct that question to the AG. Great. Thanks. All right. Any further questions at this time?
Where is he on the organization chart?
We haven't seen the organizational chart yet. We'll look at that. Are we going on to slide 7? And I think this might cover Senator Costello's question.
I believe we're on slide 9, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Project governance.
Yes, thank you. Pardon me.
Certainly. This is the project governance, kind of a pictorial. It shows the participants in each of the different committees that govern the Alaska LNG project. The sponsor group is the high-level, president-level management of the firms of BP, Conoco, Exxon, TransCanada, and Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. Dan Fowsky represents AGDC on that. In addition, the two state agencies are represented there, the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources. The things that are discussed at the sponsor level are the bigger issues that aren't resolved at lower levels. And so far, they've been things like they've discussed the fiscal terms and gas balancing, things that DNR and DOR are intimately involved with. So they've been included in that committee. The management committee, or MANCOM, is more technical in nature, and that one does not have any representatives of the agencies, just the five co-venturers. And to the extent that TransCanada leaves the venture, AGDC would stay in there, and there'd just be four parties instead of five. So that's how that would work. And the project steering committee is basically a group of engineers from each of the entities, the co-venturers, that sits and advises the project management team or reviews the work of the project management team, which is the group that, Frank's group of the engineers that actually do the work. So the project steering committee, Fritz Krusen sits on that committee for AGDC, and they provide, like it says, guidance and technical oversight of the PMT. The project management team is to Senator Costello's question earlier, that's the group that oversees the contractors that are actually doing the work. So there's 100, and Frank, if I could defer to Frank to go through that.
Madam Chairman, I'm going to move on to slide number 10. Again, Frank Richards with AGDC. This is the structure of the project management team. Joe just described the governance structure that provides for the commercial and the governance of the overall project, but the actual work is managed by the project management team, or PMT. ExxonMobil holds the lead position, or the LM position, at the top of this chart, and that is held by Mr. Steve Butt. Many of you know him. And then the direct reports to Mr. Butt, that second level down, those are the functional leads for all of the major project subgroups, from the gas treatment plant to the pipeline to environmental regulatory to technical management to the liquefaction facility. Each of those has a manager. This chart identifies within the top two tiers the location of where TransCanada currently has seconded employees. And a seconded employee is an employee that is provided by one of the co-venture partners to fill a role within the project management team. Those positions were nominated by the individual co-ventures to fulfill the job as identified by this organizational chart, and then the project management team for the top two structures must get approval for the filling of those positions by the management committee. So in this particular case, TransCanada holds the pipeline project management position as well as the facilities engineering manager position under the pipeline subgroup. And then there are other lower level technical representatives of TransCanada in the organization. So through the chair to Senator Costello, the question that I believe you had was, who will fill the role of TransCanada when they exit after a transition period? And we understand from TransCanada that they are allowing the project personnel that are currently filling these slots to remain in those slots until approximately May timeframe. This is the project management team that has been directing the pre-FEED or pre-front-end engineering and design efforts that are primarily done by contractors. So this management structure is there to oversee the contractors. This team will constrict a little bit as you end that pre-FEED work. You're not going to necessarily have all these management folks necessary until the decision is made to enter into FEED. So that FEED planning effort and what the project management team will look like at the next, through the next stage gate, will be somewhat larger. AGDC will have the opportunity to fill positions as they become available within the project management team, not only in the LNG sub-project group, but across the spectrum that you see here in the functional leads. So the process is, as a vacancy becomes available, a notice goes out to all the co-venture groups that there is a vacancy, identifying the job skills and experience required. Individual co-venture partners are able to nominate to fill those positions, and then a selection is based on the best experienced, most qualified individual selected for that job.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Costello.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So it's my understanding, and we've heard this phrase before, the best player plays. So if you've got your soccer team, you put your best striker in that position. Is this something that can change as the project changes? You said it's filled as a vacancy arises. I mean, is this something where we have different skill sets that move into the position and then they can be replaced? And a broader question related to that is, you know, is AGDC ready? Are we ready to take this on? Because I'm just curious. I read through your September 23rd meeting notes, and I was a little surprised at the percentage right now that your budget is dedicated towards AKLNG is pales in comparison to the work that's still being finished up with the Alaska Standalone Pipeline portion of your work.
Through the chair, Senator Costello. Are we ready? AGDC has just completed both the pre-FEED, or pre-front-end engineering, as well as the FEED effort for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. And again, for those in the audience, that consisted of a gas treatment plant facility on the North Slope and a 737-mile pipeline leading from the North Slope to South Central Alaska with a spur line into Fairbanks. So we feel we have completed that effort. We did it to industry standard with highly qualified, experienced program and project managers, Alaskan-based to the greatest extent possible. And we feel that those individuals who've now most of that work has been curtailed or finished, and then we're still doing just some additional work, those folks have the credentials necessary to fill the seats that would be vacated by TransCanada.
Thank you. Through the chair, the part of the question about can they be interchanged or change as time goes on?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, when you say interchange, do you mean that you'd have a rotation basis? I need to better understand your question.
What I mean is there's a vacancy and you fill it. Is that person, does that person then retain that voting position until the end of the project or for in perpetuity until we have a project that's producing gas?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, if you were talking about the individual co-venture owning that particular slot, so in this case, TransCanada is currently filling the pipeline project manager.
Actually, that's not my question. Okay. It's when we have the ability to fill those slots, will that person who has a first name and last name stay in that position? How long will they stay in that position?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I'm sorry if I misunderstood. That person would stay in that position for the duration of the job unless there was personal circumstances where they left. But that position, again, you're hired as you would a vacancy in any corporation or any other project. You hire to fill it with the best person, and I would believe their intention would be to fulfill that commitment through that portion of the project.
Follow up. So do they vote, do they act with recommendations from, let's say, AGDC, if they were, if it's AGDC's purview there, or explain to me how the vote gets translated from the AGDC board to, to that particular individual?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, for the record, Joe Dubler, AGDC. The board typically wouldn't vote on employment or appointments like that at the PMT level. That would probably be done at my level, the management level, management committee level. The structure set up so that only the top two tiers go to the management committee, and then those people are the ones that fill the slots below them. Because because, I mean, in an organization like this, and Frank's got it up there right now, there's 108 other positions. So all of those don't go to the management committee. That would be a burden on the management committee that would be, I mean, just the 27 that you see in those first two rows is a lot of work, because you get their resumes and job descriptions, and you got to go through. And we haven't had much turnover. There's been three or four, I think, that have turned over in the year and a half. But it's still, if we were doing that for every position, it would be very cumbersome. So the top two tiers are the ones that get together and just determine who the best player plays below them.
And I hate to bother you with this, but so that individual, do they use their own judgment and expertise, or do they draw upon recommendations? I mean, who will be the decision makers when the state has a voice?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, the state currently does have a voice from AGDC, and the reason we don't have anybody in the project management team currently is when it was initially set up was July of 2014. Right. July of 2014 is when they ramped up. We were still going on ASAP full speed, and we didn't have surplus bodies to put into the project. Like Frank identified, we currently do. So when an opening comes up in the project management team, AGDC, if we have a person that can fill that opening, we would recommend, here, this is our person, as would the other co-venturers. This is who we would put into that position. The person that determines who goes in there, it depends on the level, again, on the org chart. If it's a lower level position, the top two tiers get together, the L2, I believe, would get together with the L3, and they would determine based on their professional judgment. And, I mean, these guys are all experienced engineers. This is what they do. They would review the resumes that were submitted by the co-venturers, and they would make a selection based on who they thought, in their professional judgment, was the appropriate person to fill that position. For the top two tiers, the same process would take place, only the resumes would go to the management committee, and I would discuss them with Fritz, and we would see who we would vote for, and there is an actual vote who to hire. There is a recommendation by the project management team, and in this case it usually comes from the L1, would say, you know, the lead party recommends X, or, you know, John Doe. And so that would be the recommendation. We have in the past asked for everybody else's resume so we could make sure and do a compare and contrast between the recommended party and the other parties that weren't recommended to make sure that we are getting the best person. So there's it's a very robust process for putting people in the project. And, it, you know, there's a healthy tension between the three producers, because they all want their people in there, as does AGDC now that we've got people to put in there. And so there's a healthy tension every time there's an opening, people wanting to fill those positions. So I think it's a very robust process, and it's been working very well so far.
If I may, Madam Chairman, yes. Senator Costello, we just received a nomination request, and AGDC has nominated an individual to fulfill a vacancy within the project management team. So that process, as we've curtailed, slowed down the work on ASAP, as the qualified individuals are freed up, we now have the opportunity then to nominate them into vacancies.
That must be for the gas treatment, liquefaction facility.
That's correct, Madam Chairman.
Okay. Any follow-up, Senator Costello?
No, but this may be why answering the question who's in charge is so complicated.
All right, thank you. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. A couple of questions. First of all, looks like once TransCanada's out, AGDC is going to be in the pipeline business. So here we go. And these seconded employees that work under the project management team, certainly they will be working at the direction of the L1 or the project management leader, which is Steve Butt, right? But do they serve at your pleasure? Are they paid by you? And are you able to release them? And so give us that concept.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, yes, they're still employees of AGDC. and in some cases they may actually be contractors, but to the extent they're employees of AGDC, all the seconded employees remain employees of their respective companies that put them into the project. They do report to the like you said, the project management team. They are paid by the co-venturer. In other words, AGDC would still continue to pay them. We would submit a bill to the project monthly and be reimbursed for those costs.
Yes. Follow-up?
That's all I wanted to know, is because here's one of the problems that we struggled with. A change in direction from the governor on some of the change orders that you put in here, like the 48-inch line and some of the pre-feed moving forward, has caused us to wonder what the project will look like. And so these people certainly allow for some visible stability. And I guess the question for us is, do we appreciate their work to the point where we'll keep them on because it's valuable to us from TransCanada? Obviously, very valued employees by TransCanada. So I appreciate the fact that they're staying on to help us transition into the pipeline business, but or engineering business for pipelines, I guess, is probably a better way of saying it. But I don't want the rug pulled out from under them either. So your intention is to take that and work with it?
Through the chair, Senator Coggle, I believe that if they are offered to stay in the project, we would welcome that. And I just, one correction, when you said AGDC is in the pipeline business, we're back in the pipeline business. I mean, we like Frank pointed out, we went through feed on a 36-inch, you know, 737.
In the AKLNG project.
AKLNG.
We're now in the pipeline business.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
I mean, because that's probably where we're heading, and this expertise is important. And I just wanted some verbal commitment that you weren't just going to ask for the secondees and then somehow bail out on them.
No, that's not our intent at all, Senator.
So as long as we're on this org chart, I think you guys gave us this org chart, which is for you guys. That's an organizational chart. Sorry about the abbreviated language there. But this is for AGDC.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Okay. And so, committee members, I think it may be a loose piece of paper. It's black and white. At least mine is. Is this one? Is that one yours, Senator Coghill? Yours is colored. Mine's black and white. I go with the cheap version. That's all right.
There's two organizational charts, Madam Chairman, that were out on the dais.
Oh.
There's two of them. Oh, yes. Okay, this one is tiny, and this is AKLNG integrated.
Madam Chairman,
Oh, and then on the other side. Okay. What are all these? Could you help us out here?
For the record, Frank Richards, the organizational chart that's titled in the upper left-hand corner, FY 2016 Organizational Chart, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, is the actual AGDC Corporation org chart. So this identifies the executive from Dan Fowsky on down through all of the PCNs that were forwarded to the corporation by the legislature. So this is AGDC corporate org chart.
Okay, and this is the one that has kind of the lavender boxes.
Black and white.
On our desk, okay. Okay, so a question on this org chart. It is my understanding, I heard Mr. Fowsky comment in another committee hearing that in reference to Mr. Wigden Boykin, that he had the authority to fire Mr. Boykin should that become necessary at some point. Therefore, Mr. Boykin must be somewhere on this org chart, because I'm also under the impression that the AGDC board approved his continued contract.
Madam Chair,
me where I'm wrong.
Again, Frank Richards, I'll address that. What you have in front of you is, again, the PCNs, project personnel control numbers that were provided to AGDC by the legislature. So this represents the employees of the corporation. We have a tremendous amount of contractors who are also working on development of the projects for us, and they are not shown on this organizational chart.
Thank you.
So I will now ask Mr. Fowsky then to jump in on Mr. Boykin.
All right. Mr. Fowsky.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Dan Fowsky, President of Alaska Gasline Development Corp.
In reference to Mr. Boykin, he is a contractor. He is listed as the chief negotiator. He's the liaison for us, between us and the governor's office and the AKONGT. Today, he's done a great job for us in negotiating and working very closely with Joe Duber on many of the commercial contract negotiations. And I like to say that because a lot of people aren't really aware of that. There's been this unbelievable amount of work going on behind the scenes, and we're hopeful that the outcomes will start materializing. There's a great deal of effort in a project of this size and complexity. The amount of deals or arrangements or conditions that have to be met is substantial, but we are making progress. Mr. Boykin is a contractor to the corporation, and when I was asked that question directly, Mr. Boykin was hired. We analyzed what it was we were expecting from him, and what when people asked us to consider this, what his duties would be, and the first thing we said was, does this fit within the parameters of the intended use of the AKLNG fund monies? And it did, because in the liaison between both projects, we were comfortable with that. We were approached about other contractors, and we said, no, we won't do that, because it doesn't fit within the parameters. Rigdon, in that case, did meet what we considered, and we do an allocation of 85%, 15 across the board versus ASAP versus AKLNG. And we have authorized that contract out through the end of the year, is what we're currently established at, and we will reevaluate that as this process progresses through. But he is a contract employee to the corporation with close ties to the administration and his relationship with the governor, which is helpful, and has worked with him for many years, but has been a good individual to work with and is very up to speed on these negotiations and has worked very hard for us. But that is the relationship as it currently exists, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Felsky. So Mr. Boykin was hired about mid-year, I think, and his contract has been extended through the end of December. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Dan Felsky, yes, it is. That is through the end of December of 2015.
Okay. And he's paid $120,000 a month, I believe. I'm just kind of comparing that to the DNR's request. They're requesting $840,000 for a pretty important marketing position. So I'm just trying to compare costs here. That marketing position, would that come out of the AKLNG fund also?
Madam Chair, this is Dan Koski again. The contract will be reduced to $100,000 a month beginning November 1st, and the last 2 months will be at the lower level. And I'm sorry, I wasn't sure I got the last part of your question, Madam Chair.
So Mr. Boykin is being paid out of the AKLNG fund, I thought I heard you say.
Madam Chair, that is
combination.
It's a combination of the AKLNG fund and the in-state gas line fund at a rate of 85% in-state, 15% AKLNG.
I see. Okay. That was what you were saying with the 85-15. All right. Great. Thank you.
Just to be quick, that's how we allocate a lot of the costs for our contractors, depending on what they're doing. But the whole corporate mechanism is using a cost allocation formula, so to keep track of where the monies go and to make sure that they're accounted for properly, depending on the various funds being utilized.
Sure. Thank you for explaining that. I guess I'm intrigued by the fact that 85% of it is going to ASAP, because I thought you guys had sort of stopped working on ASAP at a high, a significant spend.
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Duber, we came up with a cost allocation method that was approved by the Board of Directors last year, and that was based on, while the dollar amounts that are spent by the AKLNG project are rather large because we have large cash calls every month, the actual volume of invoices is relatively small. So we allocated the overhead, basically overhead costs, or the senior management, people that you can't directly charge. Like, for instance, some of Frank's group is strictly on ASAP, so they're charged directly. This is an overhead charge for those other positions that are not, including Dan and myself and some other management and accountants is another good example. So those are allocated. I think we did an analysis of the activity that comes through the accounting department and the activity of the other managers, and that's where the 85-15 came up.
I see. Thank you. Senator Stoltz had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fauske, obviously the salaries have been a lot of discussion amongst our constituents, and they've commented them, and they certainly haven't had to solicit them. They've come. I just want to get a little better understanding. When you hired Mr. Boykin, was that with consultation of the board, or did you hire him as a CEO and unilaterally?
To the chair, Senator Stoltz, that was a negotiation that took place with me advising the board of what had taken place in that. For future consultation, I would advise the board, and I did that again at the September meeting, as to how this contract was progressing. Under the governance rules of the corporation, I had the authority to do this, but I did not do it without advising the board as I would on anything of this nature. The board did not take the technical vote. We explained it to them what was going on, and they were granted me the use of the authorization that I had after we briefed them as to the extent of the work that was going on and what we anticipated that work going forward. I would like to add that Mr. Boykin originally started under the executive branch in the governor's office. And as we moved through that, when we determined that he could come to work for us and do some work for us, we then took that on. But he had started originally under the direction of the governor.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
So thank you. So you can forward those committee minutes from AGDC on the summary of how this was, you got direction, general direction from the board to the committee?
Senator Stoltz, yes, I can.
Okay, and I just have one last question, Madam.
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
But at that salary, it was probably a lot of competition amongst hungry lawyers. Can you share with us the RFP process or the recruitment process that you went through on this? That'd be helpful as trying to respond to our constituents and helping. Even candidate Walker was very critical, even of your salary, Mr. Fauske, and it shouldn't be surprising that our constituents are asking those questions as well. Any of the documentation you can provide, and we can help explain to our constituents why you set those salaries, and what the professional recruitment requirements and the RFP, and as you selected this person, if you can provide that to the committee as well.
Senator Stoltz, I certainly will do that. Would you like me to comment it now?
Yes, please do, Mr. Fauske.
As I stated earlier, Mr. Boykin originally started with the governor's office. It had been a salary that had been negotiated to the executive branch of government. I had mentioned earlier that we were approached about utilizing his services. I did not negotiate the salary. It was a salary that was in place when we were asked to take this contract on. So there was no solicitation process. We went the original hire, if you will, or solicitor, if you will, for Mr. Boykin's services. This was a service that was brought to our attention, and we were asked if we could comply and if we could utilize the services of Mr. Boykin going forward. So it is a little bit different. I would like to say that we don't abuse this, but we were exempted from the Administrative Procedures Act in SB 138. I don't say that to say that gives us carte blanche to just go off willy-nilly and do, but we did not violate any of the procedures. This was kind of a unique situation. We tried to administer all of our contracts to an RFP process, and we certainly had a governance structure that goes to our board when we're hiring and through the budgetary process. So this was somewhat unique, I will admit, but it was in compliance with the process we have in place. And I think I've touched on everything.
So So, Madam
Yes,
Chair,
Senator Stoltz.
Just to kind of get the lineage of this, the history of this, the governor's office, through the governor's office budget, was paying Mr. Boykin $120,000 a month, and they lateraled that salary out of the governor's budget and reduced their budget and put it under the public corporation salary.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stoltz, that is certainly one way to put it. It's an accurate portrayal.
Is there another way you'd put it? I don't know. I'm trying to search for simplicity and clarity. If I've drawn a Rube Goldberg plan, which I don't think I did, I thought it was pretty clear. If there's another way, maybe you can explain how what he seems to be nodding and understanding is. What's the other way that one might look at this? I don't, other than the salary was moved from the executive branch to the public corporation with a different funding source. And
Senator Stoltz, I was just going to tease you a little bit. I was going to say, I don't know if it was a lateral or a forward pass, but it was moved out of the governor's office to the AGDC Corporation is what I was referring to.
Thanks, Coach.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fauske. All right, gentlemen, we are on slide 12, I believe. Senator Costello, did you have another question?
I actually do.
Yes, please.
Chair, and it really tags on to Senator Stoltz's question that falls under the category of things that happened at the September 23rd meeting, of which I have read the transcription. And Mr. Fauske, one of the things you mentioned is that the actions taken with relation to the subject matter about Mr. Boykin was within the purview of AGDC, and my request to you is that as we move forward, since we are in the major leagues now, that when the board makes decisions at their meetings, that some of those decisions are clarified in a more transparent and understandable way. In the example that I bring to light is when the board went into executive session two times during that meeting, and after you came out of the second executive session, there was a motion to create two subsidiaries of AGDC, and that authority does lie under 3125.120. However, in the practice of transparency and just, you know, good public relations, I think in the future it might be beneficial to all those parties involved, the public and the legislature, to cite the authority that allows you to do those actions and then perhaps explain the rationale that can be provided to the public. And that is something, I don't know if it'll come up later, Madam Chair, but I would like to have, for the very first time ever, a public recognition on the record of the rationale for creating these two subsidiaries.
It may come up later, gentlemen. The subsidiaries.
Madam Chair, if I could defer that to our General Counsel, Ken Vassar. He's on the line.
All right. Mr. Vassar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I'm not sure. The question was the rationale for the creation of the subsidiaries, is that right?
I believe that the
Senator Costello?
Yes, it's the rationale for the creation of the subsidiaries that was not given. There was no comment made in the AGDC minutes. It just happened, and you moved on.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Costello. This is part of the evolution of the AKLNG project. As the project goes forward, it's becoming more apparent that AGDC needs to prepare for the in-state distribution of the gas from the project. That's a responsibility that AGDC has by statute. There was the creation of the corporation. Actually, this was something that had been discussed at a previous board meeting some time ago. I think it was maybe a year ago. But time wasn't right then. It's becoming ripe as we discuss matters more with the producers and their interest in arranging for these kinds of things. So this came up during the course of that meeting that the time seemed right to go ahead and create the corporations. The AGDC gas aggregator company will be the is intended to be the subsidiary corporation of AGDC that will provide for the gas that will be distributed locally in state, and that's its only function. Part of the discussion about that was had in executive session because if something that relates to AKLNG and the status of discussions and negotiations with the AKLNG parties, and it's more common than not for us to discuss that kind of thing in executive session because the confidentiality agreements that are in place for AKLNG are of that, what I mentioned before, the very broad variety that private industry is used to. And we have to be very careful about what we say about our discussions with the AKLNG parties as a result of that. But this was just a timing situation. The time now is better than it was a year ago, and it's as we're nearing the end of pre-feed and starting to think about feed, we felt that it was a good time to go ahead and create these corporations. I would add also that the corporations have been created, as many of you probably know, creating a corporation is a pretty simple process. It basically involves putting together a set of articles of incorporation and paying a $50 filing fee with the Department of Commerce. And that's really all we've done with those corporations so far is we've just set them up so that they're on the shelf and they're available, and we can pull them off the shelf and start using them just as soon as there's a need for them.
Senator Costello, follow up?
Thank you, and I certainly understand that. That's why I cited the statute that gave the corporation the power to do that. So there was a lengthy discussion about the gas aggregation corporation, but there was Mr. Hugh Short made a motion that created two corporations, and Commissioner Dragas seconded it. So is there any further explanation of the second corporation?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Costello. Ken Vassar here. The other corporation is an asset holding company, and this is also becoming a more timely proposition as this issue of whether TC is going to be bought out or not. If it is bought out, then there will be some assets that will be transferred over, and again, we wanted to. We're not using the corporation right this minute, and I'm not sure when we would start using it. But just to have it available so that we have a corporation that can hold assets and on behalf of AGDC in, as we go forward with the AKLNG project.
You know, it strikes me that This proposed buyout of TransCanada obviously has been in the works for quite a while because this was done at a September board meeting and the legislature is only now being asked to appropriate the money for it. So this has been a lengthy process for TransCanada. Just commenting. Senator Cargill, you had a question.
Yeah, just on, I understand the aggregator, but the holding company, is that to mirror a holding company that TransCanada has? Is that so you can transfer those things? And is it a good vehicle to do that? Or is that the purpose at all for it?
Through the chair, Senator Cargill, for the record, Joe Dubler, AGDC. The holding company was set up to hold the assets of the AKLNG project and not necessarily particular to the TransCanada assets that would transfer. There would also be the LNG portion, and it's just a typical a typical move that corporations do to segregate their different business lines. That we wanted to keep the corporate structure of AGDC as kind of an umbrella corporation and have separate subsidiary corporations to handle different assets that we may have. You know, maybe down the line we would be the statutes require us to begin looking at delivering non-oil hydrocarbons throughout the state once construction has begun on a large diameter pipeline. So once that happens, if we're looking at delivering, whether it's trucking LNG, whether it's doing CNG, whatever it is, we would have the ability to create other subsidiaries to hold those assets as well and to separate the businesses so that if one of them runs into a snag, it doesn't affect the rest of the corporation.
Okay, yeah,
follow-up, Senator Cargill?
I actually anticipated one of my questions, potential other corporations. I think one of the things that we're concerned about, and you've heard asked many, many times on, you know, who's in charge, but it becomes apparent to me that you're working into, from ASAP into the AKLNG project delivery. But that also asks the question, do you anticipate any of the scope changes at this point? Because these scope changes that we're now aware of, we've heard more about the 48-inch line, but we certainly didn't hear about moving things from, you know, the feed to the pre-feed stage. Any other scope changes that you anticipate or you see coming your way?
Through the chair, Senator Cargill, no, we're not aware of any others. This is the final recommendation from the PMT, and it's currently being considered by Alico Ventures.
Okay, and then one other question, and this might go to the legal counsel, is did this come to the AGDC board from the governor's office, or was that something that came from the from within the board?
Through the chair, Senator Cargill, it was actually recommended to the board through staff by Rigdon and Boykin that we begin setting up subsidiaries to hold the different assets of the corporation, and it's something we had thought about for quite a while, and it just seemed like the right time to do it.
You know, I think the fundamental purpose of Senator Costello's questions was that question of transparency. You know, the confidentiality agreements are not as robust as industry would like, on the premise that this is an open and transparent process, and yet board minutes are vague. And so we're just trying to figure out if it's one thing or another. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions on this page? All right. We've done the secundes, right? Am I correct?
Quick question, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. Senator Wilkowski.
Are your board meetings open to the public?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes. We are subject to the Open Meetings Act, and all of our board meetings are public.
Madam Chairman, the slide that you have in front of us is what we had used through the finance committees, and we had made modifications to the deck to, if there was the goal of the committee to talk about in-state demand, then we do have slides that we've incorporated into that, or at your pleasure, we can continue to advance as we are. How would you like us to proceed?
We're talking about in-state. Why don't we go to the in-state pages?
Okay.
Those begin on slide 23.
That's correct.
Okay.
So, Madam Chairman, part of our enabling legislation was that we would have the responsibility, AGDC, for developing pipelines and other mechanisms for delivering natural gas in state. So, to meet that goal, we have looked to develop a forecast for the in-state natural gas demand from the present out through 2040, and then looked at what the additional cost estimates for offtake facilities that would be associated with the either of the gas line projects, so we would have an idea of what it would take or what it would cost to offtake the gas at those locations, and then looking to develop a framework to be able to present to the legislature as the policymakers in evaluating in-state offtake infrastructure, because ultimately it's going to be a policy decision, because AGDC is not funded currently to construct those offtakes or any delivery systems downstream from those offtakes. So most recently, as we were talking about the subsidiary and that is the aggregation of the in-state gas demand. And I think that maybe that conversation has gone far enough, or if you'd like me to continue, I can identify that it was as the three last bullets were directed towards.
Okay, before you go on, first I want to welcome Representative Vasquez, who's been here for a while. You said that AGDC wasn't funded presently to provide for the offtakes. Could you say that again just so I understand?
Madam Chairman, AGDC has not been funded for any construction activities associated with this. So for the AKLNG project and for the ASAP project, it was project development through pre-feed and feed only. So we have done the studies, but not the actual cost of construction.
Okay. I appreciate that. And just for members, in the uncodified part of SB 138, it instructs for this particular subject matter that AGDC collaborate with AEA, the Alaska Energy Authority. It was in Section 75 of SB 138, to consider infrastructure to deliver gas from the North Slope gas pipeline. So that's what we're referring to here. So would the state be expected to fund the actual physical offtake points and the infrastructure to the communities? Do you have any sense of where that stands, Mr. Richards?
Madam Chairman, the project envisioned that there would be five offtakes, and that was the presentation and the representation by the project to the state of Alaska. So in the work efforts that we've done to look at the actual physical kit or the facilities needed to take those offtakes, we looked at what the spectrum of offtake volumes would be. So if you have a line that's flowing 3.3 billion cubic feet a day, and we're looking at a community that may only have 40,000 cubic feet of potential gas supply, we needed to look at what that kit would be able to allow that. We really have to look at depressurizing the gas, metering the gas, odorizing the gas, to be able to bring it to a state that you could then allow it to flow to a potential local distribution system in a local service district for that particular community. So our role has been to essentially come up with four discrete offtake kits, a mini, a macro, a nano, and a micro.
Madam Chair, they're on slide 30 for the record.
Okay, so slide 30 for the listening audience. Okay.
So here you have the four various offtake facility volume considerations, as well as the actual cost estimate. So we took this kit and we designed it, and we actually came up then with a cost estimate to construct it. So again, these are in $2015 dollars, but we wanted to make a representation of what that was going to be. Now, the decision of who is going to pay for that, I'll refer to my colleague on the commercial side.
Madam Chair, we looked at the costs, and you can see them up there for a very small community. Just the offtake skid is $14 million. So if you're talking a community the size of, say, Anderson, or Cantwell, or the very small communities, maybe 200 people, 300 people, to fund a $14 million facility just to get the gas off, and then you run a pipe into the community, it may be 2 miles, it may be 5 miles. The expense to do that is, on a per capita basis, like most things in Alaska, doesn't pencil. So we assume there would be some form of subsidy if the state makes the decision that all of the communities along the route need to have gas or should have gas. We're assuming there will be some type of subsidy involved, because frankly, you wouldn't be able to afford to do that. Currently, the NSTAR system in Anchorage and the Mount Valley has been funded through NSTAR, has paid, and the rate payers have reimbursed them through tariffs that they've paid over the years. The difference between between those communities and the ones we're talking about is the volume of people and the density of the, that population compared to the communities along the route. And we think that, you know, that that'll be a decision that, that state policymakers make down the road.
Very good. Senator Welikowski.
Do you have a rough estimate of what the tariffs would be for the for each one of these? The additional tariffs.
Through the chair, Senator Welikowski, we have put together a presentation for our board. We haven't given it to our board yet. We intend to do that at the next board meeting, and we would make it available to the legislature at that time.
Can you give us a preview? We don't have the tariffs. I'm just curious what kind of, how much were dollar-wise, $1, $2, $3?
Oh, no, for the small communities and some of the smaller communities, it was like $100. And that's what I mean. It just, it's beyond anything you can say, well, maybe if we did this, it's out there. And again, it's the same issue we've got all over Alaska. There's too few people, and the costs are too large to do things. The same thing with schools. I mean, you look at a school for 25 kids, and it's $12 million. Well, you know, in the lower 48, they'd never build that school, but we do here, and it's a good thing, you know. But and this may be the same case, it may be different. That's for the 61 policymakers in the state to determine, not the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation.
Senator Coghill.
Just as a matter of business, this is part of what this aggregator corporation would look at. Would it be under your board, or would it be under this other aggregator subsidiary?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the aggregator function wouldn't be actually providing the utility services. There would have to be some utility, either another state entity or, you know, a private entity expanding into these areas. The aggregator would be the one that sits between the gas owners, which are the three producers, and Department of Natural Resources, and those utilities. So the aggregator would add up what all of these little communities would have or would need, and then go to the producers and DNR and try to acquire that gas. And then basically the issue is if the producers have to deal with more than 10 entities, they come under the jurisdiction, I believe, and I'm not a regulatory expert, but my understanding is they would come under the jurisdiction of the RCA, which would put RCA oversight on this project. If the aggregator sits in the middle, that won't be the case. We would still continue to have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, Section 3 oversight of this project, since it is an integrated LNG project, and not have the RCA have to deal with it.
And I get that, and thanks for instructing us on the regulatory part of it. But you'd be sitting at this point, if and when it looks like TransCanada goes out, you will be sitting at the table with the project management team and up, right? And so, but this subsidiary then becomes a different entity, and I just was wondering if it would be under the direction of the board, or how does that work? Because at that point, there's probably going to have to be a firewall between what you do with the AKLNG project and what happens in the spinoff.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's correct. I believe the indication we've got from our council is that they could have the same board, but the staff would have to be different for those functions. And that's why we set up a subsidiary corporation to do it.
Senator Costello, you had a question.
Yes, thank you. So can communities, or are communities then required to go through the aggregator corporation, or would they have the flexibility to join together outside of that and make agreements with another entity to be the one that collects the, you know, does that work that the aggregator corporation would do?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, they certainly would have the ability to do it on their own. The aggregator function would step in the middle for communities. For instance, if Talkeetna wanted to do it, they may not have the sophistication to be able to go and negotiate gas supply agreements with the three producers and the Department of Natural Resources. And the idea is that they would want to have the aggregator go and do that. And also, if there's one agreement or one one amount of gas that the aggregator is going to the producers and DNR with, they can probably get a better deal than if it's each individual community going on their own with a small amount of gas.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Costello.
So conceptually, then, the aggregator corporation that has been established could be competing with another corporation for the business of those communities.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, in theory, yes. I mean, there could be a for-profit entity that would want to come in and do it. I suppose that is possible, yes.
One more. So yes, Senator Costello.
Just looking through the meeting notes, it sounds like the decision was made that the AGDC board would be the boards for both of the corporations that were set up.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I believe that's correct, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Have you had any success in negotiating a gas price in your dealings with the producers?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, not to date. Price of the gas delivered, there's going to be a lot of components to that, as you might imagine. The delivery price, it would depend on whether we buy it at the wellhead and pay the transportation costs, or whether they deliver the gas and we pay a delivered price. We have not done those negotiations yet.
The transportation costs, actually, we won't have to pay a tariff if we're part owner of the pipeline. Is that true?
Madam Chair, the we there is the key. We being the state,
yes.
If we're selling the gas to a community, for instance, NSTAR, they would pay a transportation charge and a cost of gas on the slope. So they would definitely pay some type of tariff to compensate the state for putting in the infrastructure. And actually, not just the state. The current intent is for all the parties to provide, well, this is the state's desire, at least, for all the parties to provide a pro rata share of gas for in-state use, so that each participant, what that will do for the project is keep alignment along the whole line. If the state provided all of the gas for in-state use, that's about 240, 250 million cubic feet. Well, that would reduce the state's use of the LNG facility, because obviously we can't make LNG out of gas that we sell in state. Mm-hmm. So we would have an asset in an LNG facility that's underutilized in the state's portion, and that's not a desirable outcome for the state.
But so let me ask you this then. If we were getting a higher price for exported LNG than we would for in-state use, what would you, as the person, the group standing in for the state, what would your priority be, in-state use or export?
Madam Chair, the AGDC is not the gas owner, so the gas owner is the Department of Natural Resources and the three producers. Okay. We are simply providing a service to treat the gas, transport the gas, and liquefy the gas for the gas owners. So the gas owners are the ones that would determine the price of the gas and through negotiations with either the aggregator or directly with NSTAR or other utilities. And the in-state gas portion is a concept that the producers and the state are all behind. Mm-hmm. As far as pricing, it's very touchy talking about pricing in public between competitors. Mm-hmm. There's antitrust considerations, so that won't be a public discussion, I can assure you. But the pricing of the LNG versus in-state gas, the in-state gas will be delivered regardless. I mean, that's been a commitment that the producers have made to provide state or provide gas to the citizens of Alaska. And the price of that will, and this is an assumption that I've made and that others have made, is that it'll be somehow tied to the price of gas that would otherwise be delivered to Asia or wherever it's delivered. So it's kind of a netback kind of pricing where you obviously wouldn't be paying the LNG for liquefaction, but you would the way gas is priced in LNG is a netback base. They look at what they sell it for, they deduct all the costs, and that's what the netback or the cost of or the price they're getting for their gas at the wellhead. Mm-hmm. And so that's the price that you would take and then take the GTP, the gas treatment, and the transportation and apply those tariffs to it, and that would be the price for in-state gas. That's my assumption is how it would work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, is that Mr. Fusky?
Sure, it is, Madam Chair. May I have permission to add on to a little bit of what Mr. Duber has been saying?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair, again, Dan Fosky. We have a kind of a two-headed spear going on here. You have HB 4, which mandates that we deliver gas to Alaskans at the lowest possible cost. And then you have Senate Bill 138 that says we're to maximize the state's resources. As I testified that night at Palmer, I had said to legislators, this might be one of the toughest decision cases that we end up doing because Mr. Dewar, Joe has touched on earlier that these costs, when you start including the sleds to owner-rise the gas, to pressurize the gas, are at a high comparison to the population base that we have to support those CapEx costs, and he's even moving on to the operational costs. What I'd like to just stress is we are mandated to do a lot of work on this, and the way of delivering that gas to our citizens has not yet been determined. And I mentioned in my previous testimony that I'm a guy who grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Iowa, and to this day you can go back to Iowa, and there's LNG natural propane trucks going all over delivering gas to farms and industry that resides off the grid. I'm not here suggesting that. I'm here saying but there are a variety of ways that we're going to have to explore to get our citizens gas, and it's going to be, as you've heard me talk many times, one of the reasons we live in a state that is because there's not many of us. One of the difficulties for projects like this is because there's not many of us. These are huge capital costs that have to be spread over a thin population base, and in many times over vast distances. So I just want to assure the committee that we're going to endeavor to make every available option out there for our citizens. We're also mandated under HB 4 to include 1.5% of propane mm-hmm. in the gas coming down in the lean gas model, which equated to about 4,000 barrels a day of propane, so that we could explore gas down the Yukon or down the Richardson Highway. So we're also mandated, and we are doing this working with AEA and DNR and others to develop and we have Lisa Wilcox here, who was very instrumental along with others to write the gas usage plan, or in-state gas demand, which we plan on releasing here shortly. And as Mr. Richards has pointed out, we have done a bunch of pre-engineering work and estimates as to what the four different sleds that could be used to get this gas to our citizens. So I just like to encourage people that we're on this. It's going to be difficult, but not impossible. We just need to figure out ways to get energy. I cannot for the life of me ever envision a pipeline going by a community and we're going to figure out that there's no way to get it to our citizens. I believe that is an unacceptable conclusion or a solution. And so I just wanted to add the various mandates that have been handed to this corporation through the last few years, and that we're working on, and that we're going to keep going until we have a successful outcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fosky. You're right. There are certainly some. That's just one of the studies that was requested of AGDC. The other one was in collaboration with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities related to the bridge crossing of the Yukon River. And perhaps this I'll ask right now. I know that there are brackets in place on that new bridge that would carry a gas pipeline. Are those adequate? Have you considered those? Mr. Richards, you look like you might have an answer.
Madam Chairman, the study you just referred to is actually for a new bridge on a new alignment. The current bridge crossing the Yukon River, the Patton Bridge, does have a second set of hangars. Those hangars are owned by Alyeska Pipeline, not by the state of Alaska. The bridge is owned by the state, but Alyeska retained those rights. We have looked at utilizing those brackets, and we've also looked at the challenges of getting the pipeline to that location, in addition to looking at alternative stream crossings across the Yukon River. So it is part of the work that's being done right now on the pre-feed work for Alaska LNG, and it's similar to the study that we did for the ASAP project.
Very good. All right. Any other questions at this point? All right, I'll let you go on to slide. Are we on 31 now on gas optic?
Yeah, we certainly can, Madam Chairman, if you'd like. Dan mentioned that we did have Lisa Wilcox, it sounds like, in attendance, and she is actually the author of the study. So, Dan, I'm not sure if you wanted Lisa to make this presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Dan. We do have Lisa here, and we go back into what, slide 25, Frank?
No, we're on slide 31, Dan.
Okay, what would you like Lisa to present? Well, we're a little confused.
Okay, I apologize, Dan. I was out of order there. What Lisa did was to look at the in-state gas demand, and you may have
on slide 25.
You start on slide 24.
24, great, thank you.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Okay, for the record, this is Lisa Wilcox. I'm a commercial advisor working at AGDC. AGDC conducted a forecast analysis of in-state demand for the period of the forecast was done for the period of 2015 to 2040. There were a couple of purposes to this. One purpose was to ensure AGDC and the state of Alaska and DNR to fulfill our statutory and corporate obligations to ensure that this project could provide in-state gas in the quantity that it was necessary. Another purpose was actually for the project itself to provide a more realistic picture, or a more precise picture, I'd say, of what we think the forecast looks like for in-state gas use for actually the model and for the technical design. In the past, the number that we've had of 500 million standard cubic feet a day was a rather broad number. It equates to a high monthly wintertime use, but there are a lot of there are obviously a lot of variables that feed into that number, so we just wanted to get a better picture of what that demand would look like into the future during the operation of the project. So to do that, we analyzed on slide 24, you'll see we'll analyze historical natural gas production and consumption data for each of the major customers for in-state gas. And then for going into the future, we identified what the existing and potential demand segments would be, such as power generation, natural gas for natural gas used for space heating, natural gas consumed by industrial facilities such as mining prospects. And then we developed a range of demand assumptions for those sectors. So we made some fairly simple assumptions. You know, there's been a lot of technical studies that have been done on use of natural gas by household and tying them to the potential efficiencies that could be instituted in the future for energy consumption, and tying that to population growth and so forth. Our analysis was more economic. It was not as complex than that. We were trying to get a reasonably broad but a good indicative forecast for a fairly long time period. So that's just the qualifications that I'd make around this forecast. So in the next slide, you can see our base case, which I guess we consider the most likely scenario.
So that's slide 25.
Correct.
Yeah, that is slide 25. So this scenario is considered maybe base case or most likely scenario for in-state natural gas demand. And I can explain the area charts a little bit better. So on the bottom, we have the largest single in-state customer for in-state gas, and that can be named as NSTAR because everybody knows they have all of South Central natural gas consumption that they take care of. The estimates for NSTAR, and actually for a lot of the other existing utilities, were based on looking at what they've got past, looking at their recent developments, looking at their recent changes of demand, and looking at the contracts that they've already made with the gas sales and purchase contracts that they've made with upstream producers. And that gave us that pretty good and a public data-based indication of where that demand would go in the future. And then we imposed basically a growth assumption going out from 2015 of, in the base case for most customers, it was 1% growth for those that already exist, that we think reasonably represents expectations of population growth versus efficiencies that may be realized in the future. So the bottom slice is NSTAR. Then the next slice is South Central Power Utilities, which includes Chugach, Homer Electric, Matanuska Electric Association, who am I missing? And MLMC, of course. So those are existing utilities that utilize natural gas for power generation. And then you can see the Fairbanks utilities that have a much more aggressive growth profile. We made the assumption and relied on the Interior Energy Project's estimates of what that growth would be. You can see that we've estimated that the growth would ensue prior to the completion of this project. So natural gas would come from Cook Inlet, we assume, to kind of supply the period between now and the startup of this pipeline, and potentially some of it would continue to come from Cook Inlet. We didn't make assumptions to the contrary. So that's the dark brown wedge on the slide. I hope you have this one in color. On the Cook Inlet field use, Cook Inlet field use is basically, actually, let me get back to the Cook Inlet field use when I talk about Cook Inlet production.
Do you care to have an explanation of each of the tranches?
That would probably not be necessary. We could probably do just a more high-level overview.
30,000-foot okay. level, Lisa.
Yes.
All right, thank you. I should have asked at the beginning what kind of footage you wanted on the overview. So you can see that it's a steady, increasing profile into the future, and really the bottom line is that in our study we also assume that Cook Inlet would continue to produce, that would continue to supply some of the resources. We worked with DNR to establish what a reasonable base case profile would be, and that black line in the middle of the chart essentially represents the difference or the shortfall in gas demand that some new source of gas would have to fill, and in our assumption would come from HLNG. So you can see that it grows to about 260 million cubic feet a day annual average by 2040. Questions on this slide?
I don't see any.
Okay.
Slide 26.
Yeah, and On the next slide, which is slide 26, it is basically a numerical summary of the same chart. So I can, I think the determination that we made was one of those purposes of the project volumes are more than adequate to meet in-state demand growth. Demand will continue to be partially met by Cook Inlet throughout the life of the project.
All right, page line 20 or slide 27.
Slide 27 gets more into probably into Frank's territory, into how the new demands in the smaller communities in the state of Alaska would be developed and then supplied.
Madam Chairman, as we described earlier, again, the purpose of the AKNG will be to not only meet the commercialization for revenue generation, but also for in-state long-term supply for energy needs. So with that, then, we're trying to make an understanding of what's the financial commitment by the state of Alaska, as we talked about in regards to the offtake kits and then potentially downstream from those, including the lateral costs and or local distribution systems, and likely even the home conversion costs in these communities. So we are working on that as charged under Senate Bill 138 in the latter sections. We are, again, as we said, working with the Alaska Energy Authority as well as with DNR to look at a framework that would help then the policymakers in evaluating the options.
Very good.
So we did a significant amount of work on the ASAP project in part of the environmental impact statement, looking at the socioeconomic benefits of that project. And so the framework that we're talking about is kind of, we're building on that work right now. And so with that, then, we're looking at the facilities that would be required to meet that demand, including Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And then we talked about probably the three main offtake points, which would be Anchorage and Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and then the Kenai and the Kiski area. So we defined those earlier as North and South Cook Inlet. That'd be the Anchorage and the Nikiski site. And then we're looking at, in our role in assisting the KNG, we're looking at the technical and economic feasibility of those communities with close proximity to the gas, because that has to be considered then in the socioeconomic impacts of the resource reports for the Alaska LNG project. And then, again, collaboration with the Alaska Energy Authority on alternative means for delivering that. So the schematic on page 29 really indicates the top level portion is, again, the gas supplies coming from the Prudhoe Bay unit and the Point Thompson unit, or PBU and PTU, through a gas treatment facility, down a pipeline to a liquefied natural gas plant, and then to export. You'll see the down arrows coming off that main pipeline are the interconnection or offtake points. So the circular area going in a vertical direction include that offtake facility, and then it includes the transmission line to that community or resource development opportunity in Alaska. And then from that down into a local utility through possibly a local service district, to individual homes and or power plants and or resource developers. So we're looking at all those costs to be able to try and provide that then as a resource for consideration by the legislature and ultimately for us with our board of directors, and then trying to identify the project-related costs as well as the non-project-related costs.
So one of the complexities, of course, with this idea of delivering to consumers is that there's probably two grades of gas needed. There's a different grade needed for export, that is a richer gas, versus a leaner, burner tip ready gas for consumers. That's going to be an issue to address. Is that true?
That is true, Madam Chairman. And again, from our project development with ASAP, we were looking at a utility-grade gas mm-hmm. pipeline and gas conditioning facility. On the Alaska LNG project, the grade of the gas is going to be to meet the LNG market demands. Mm-hmm. So where you currently have a system in place, such as NSTAR, and they have a specification in regards to the BTU content of their gas, any gas flowing into that system must meet the need of their system, unless they make modifications to their specification based on what you just saw in terms of the decline of the Cook Inlet and what the gas compositions would be. There may be a migration. That all has to be worked out commercially with the local distribution provider, in this case NSTAR. For the new utilities such as Fairbanks or any of the small communities, based on the BTU level of the gas, you may find that the existing gas stream can go into those communities without additional straddle plants to be able to pull off those liquids.
Mm-hmm. I see. Very good.
So we've moved on to slide 30. We've talked about that in regards to the cost of the offtakes. And then in progress to date, we've been looking at 20 potentially interconnection points. And again, basing off the work that we did with the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, we looked at communities that were within approximately 60 miles either side of the pipeline corridor. So for both the ASAP project and NKNG, we have a common corridor, so we're able to utilize that.
40 miles each.
It's actually 60, I believe. So those communities, when we look to them individually, it would be very expensive, but we'll look to see if we could come to a common point where you would have a single offtake, and then maybe you could have distribution lines leading to communities in close proximity to each other. So we wanted to look at, again, meeting our charge of providing the gas at the lowest possible cost. We came up with 20 possible interconnection points. And then we're developing the cost estimates as well as the facility's design to be able to meet those needs. And that's what we will be presenting to our board.
All right. Slide 32.
So in summary, Madam Chairman, again, no decisions have been made by AGDC. We have not put any public money has been appropriated for the construction of any of these facilities. So we are looking at, in the planning effort, what it would take to be able to accomplish this and then be able to come back and represent that to the legislature for their consideration. And then ultimately, user fees and tax assessments alone may not be enough to be able to finance these gas distribution systems, especially in these smaller communities. And so it's going to be a phased approach where some facilities may be constructed during the actual construction of the pipeline and others may come on at a later date as demand grows in those communities. And that's always an opportunity.
So this kind of information must be part of, I think it's research report number 7, socioeconomic impact in the NEPA process.
I believe it's resource report 5.
5, thank you. So the work you're doing will mesh with what AKLNG is doing as well, or you'll be part of that?
Madam Chairman, we are part of that, correct.
All right, very good. Further questions from committee members? All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here, Mr. Richardson and Mr. Dubler. Yes, Senator Costello.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't
know
we were wrapping up.
Oh,
I do have a question. Are you aware of a vision or a new direction that Governor Walker has for the gas line for Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, could you please clarify? I don't understand the question. New vision.
Well, it actually precedes a question about something that I read in the meeting notes from the September 23rd meeting this year. And on page 27, the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development sits on the board of AGDC, and there's a discussion about the message that AGDC will have for Alaskans. And in the middle of that, she says, and if we're going to ask people to vote on a constitutional amendment next general election, and so could you comment on that? Are you aware of a constitutional amendment that's being planned to be put before the voters?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, yes, the constitutional amendment that is anticipated to be put before the voters would, and I'm not an attorney, but I think I've got a pretty good understanding of it. The ability, and Ken, if you would like to respond to this, let me know. I'd be more than happy to have our general counsel respond to this.
Madam Chair, if I may?
Yes, please, Mr. Vassar.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Tim Vassar, AGDC. What this relates to is the concept of fiscal stability. What the producers would like to have is as much certainty as possible regarding the tax climate in Alaska. If they're going to invest a great deal of money in a pipeline, of course, they want to have some idea of what kind of tax system will be in place that they'll have to include in the expenses for running the gas through the system. With that fiscal certainty, though, and what that would suggest or what they would like, I think, is that there would be some kind of either a set rate or a limitation on the amount of the tax over the at least the period of financing for the project. It was something like 20 years or 30 years or something like that. But in order to do that, we cannot contract away our taxing ability. And so under the state constitution as it reads right now. So what's being proposed for a constitutional amendment is an amendment that would, I don't think the wording of it has been settled yet, but or drafted yet, but the essence of it would be that in order to induce the producers to continue to go forward and help them with the financing issue, the state would have the ability to contractually bind itself to either, like I said, set a particular tax rate or at least put a cap on what the tax would be so that they would know what to expect going forward. And we can't do that now. We need a constitutional amendment for that.
And Madam Chair, for the record, this is Joe Duba. The issue is that you can't bind future legislatures, and by fixing the tax rate, you would be in effect doing that. And so this would be an amendment to the and I'm probably using the wrong word. It would modify the Constitution to allow it in this very limited instance for an LNG project gas line.
Yes, that was a good explanation. One of the other factors we've heard at our two updates over the summer is the timing of that, of course. The legislature would have to approve that constitutional amendment to be put on the ballot before the ballots were printed for the November election in 2016. And I know certainly Senator Coghill has depth of understanding on that. Those actions by the legislature, but there was a time constraint, and so that was actually one of the items that we had hoped to see on this special session call, but it didn't happen. So I suspect we'll be addressing it either in regular session or even next summer, since there is a deadline for that. Any further questions? Senator Costello.
Madam Chair, I was just hoping that the committee could receive a copy of the proposed regulations on the confidentiality.
Yes, we will pursue that. I know my staff has taken that note, and we'll pursue that with the Attorney General. We've been instructed that is the person who wrote them, proposed them, whatever. Any further questions? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not a question I expect an answer to here, and many of the people I'm asking are probably just at rapt attention listening to your chairmanship of this committee. But I think the administration really needs to define what the project is more clearly. The public expectations in the interior have been for consumer ability to the in-state use, and many of the offtakes, I think, like just like when you build a water line, and we both have communities that know the barriers to even hook up to that, and so they exist on hauling water. I think the administration really needs to use their pulpit and define where they're going on this. Really, he went to Japan. I don't know what was all entailed in the slideshow in the presentation, but that's clearly exporting as a priority. As many Alaskans view this gas line as in the interior, this is really a survival mode of having energy at the furthest most populated area at that latitude in the world that's still on diesel, and there are expectations there are expectations this is going to be the panacea for our budget issues, but we can't. And it reminds me of some of the scenes in Rain Man. We're going to have a revenue-producing gas line with lots of offtakes and availability for cheap gas for every community. It's almost like, yeah, I want to live where the Dustin Hoffman character said, yeah, I want to live with you in Los Angeles in Cincinnati. And I'm not trying to be confrontational, but I think the administration really needs to be more upfront with the public on where they're going with their vision. They're asking us to make big steps, divesting the business partner and turn it over to state government. The state government make business decisions. What are those going to be, if it's going to be a viable economic project versus one that subsidizes Alaskans? I don't think those questions have really been vetted, and I think we're still in campaign mode with a lot of high expectations on this gas line, with certainly different paths being explored that don't offer many of those expectations that that communities that voted for a vision and whatever path we're on right now. And I guess I find myself, and I'm sure there's commentators that write Sunday columns will comment on my confusion, but I will admit to confusion on where we're at on this and go at it, folks. But I think there's a schizophrenia in this presentation, in how this is being presented by the administration, with the expectations of communities. We're going to get gas for Alaskans, and we're going to maximize revenues. Again, like in Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman couldn't be with his brother Raymond in Los Angeles and still be at the Institute in Cincinnati. It's really daunting at how we get to this, and I don't have near the pulpit the governor has to clarify what the state vision is on this, because I think there's not a lot of clarity. And I guess, Madam Chair, that was really, I don't expect any response, or that's really only one person can answer that. Thank you for indulging that question/statement.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. I know certainly the senators from the Matsu Valley have very remote districts. Those folks actually are expecting the gas to be available to them, despite the fact they're in very small communities. Those senators are having the difficult task of explaining the economics are probably not going to make that feasible. So we may be calling on AGDC to assist us in explaining the economics, because that would be a difficult conversation. However, I also know that there is a private company that is looking at barging gas, either compressed or propane, around the coast, Dutch Harbor being one. I know the company is also looking at Hawaii, of course. I think there'll be innovation on the part of the private sector to get the needs met as well. So that's good, as long as the state doesn't step in and preempt private sector businesses from doing that kind of thing. And that actually has happened recently. My staff has made me aware that I actually have the confidentiality regs here in my binder, which I will rapidly copy for the rest of the committee. I see that the public comment on those ended on October 21, which I think was about a week ago. But in any case, I will get this distributed to committee members. Any further comments or questions? All right, seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Richards, Mr. Dublow, for being with us, and thank you to all the AGDC folks that were on the phone with us as well. We will adjourn the meeting at this time. Let the record reflect, the time is 5:24 p.m. Thank you.